Fugitives, a history of Nazi mercenaries during the Cold War. From Spain to Syria, the thrilling untold history of Nazi fugitives turned post-war agents for America, the Soviets, the Third World, or themselves. After the Second World War, the Allied vowed to hunt Nazi war criminals to the ends of the earth. Yet, as we know, many slipped away or were shielded by the West in exchange for cooperation in the unfolding confrontation with communism. It is the story behind a great new book by Danny Auerbach called Fugitives, A History of Nazi Mercenaries During the Cold War. Delighted to be joining me live on the line. Danny himself. Danny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts are you today, by the way? Where do we find you this morning?
I'm in Jerusalem, in my home in Israel.
Ah, super. Right then. Now, many of us perhaps are familiar with the fact that many of the high-ranking Nazis slipped the net during the confusion and chaos of the final days of the Second World War. Was it a case that, you know, the Allies wanted to get hold of them because of the information they had, the technology that they had, and the Soviets wanted to get hold of them because of the information that they had? What was set the scene, if you like, for the confusion and the chaos at the during the downfall, those final days in Berlin?
You know, even when the Allies really want to catch Nazis, and it was in the beginning, let's say 1946, 1947, in the first 1 or 2 years, military system, justice system, police systems, bureaucratic systems are very cold. There were many lists, sometimes the name varied from list to list, they were even spelled differently, and many people were able to escape through the holes in this net. But very, very soon, the Second World War became a thing of the past. And you know, one of the most fascinating things I saw in my research for this book, how quickly enmities disappeared. You could fight, you know, the most vicious foe. And then a few years pass, you have new enemies, you have new troubles, and you are engrossed in your new troubles. And the enemy of the past becomes very, very gradually, but sometimes quickly, sometimes something of justice, of history, of abstract ideas, but not of pressing need. And the pressing need of the Western Allies after the Second World War was to gain intelligence on the Soviet Union. They had very little. They knew very little of the Soviet Union. The Soviet conventional army in Europe was much larger, and it reminds us what we see today in Ukraine. And they had to know. They had to know the Soviets. They thought, who knows the Soviets better than these Nazi intelligence agents just fought them in the recent past? And that was the basis or the infrastructure for the plot I describe in my book.
The saying, isn't it, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And also,
enemy.
Yeah, well, former enemy, exactly. But also because the West was absolutely paranoid about, as Churchill said, the Iron Curtain falling down over Europe. And it was chaotic. And, you know, as I said, many, you know, you go into Germany, Austria, that situation, Poland, it's a case of people fleeing, large amounts of refugees heading towards the West. It's very easy for high and middle ranking officers to lie low because it's a big country and there is, you know, the Allies are worrying more about what's happening with the Soviets as well.
I'll tell you something even more fascinating. Even these Nazi spies that they studied and didn't lie low, that worked for several Allied intelligence agencies, very often these people were crooks, mercenaries, intelligence peddlers, and they sold garbage intelligence to Allied agencies. And sometimes these Allied agencies discovered relatively quickly that this is garbage intelligence. And then you see something astounding. You see the same crooks working for another Allied intelligence agency and selling the same crap. So the different Allied intelligence agencies did not even connect or share information with one another. And therefore, you can see these mercenaries, these Nazi intelligence peddlers, just gaining money out of the chaos, out of the post-war intelligence chaos.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you would have thought that most of the Nazis would have got on the famous rat line, you know, gone via Italy or come through Spain. Franco, of course, you know, a fascist dictator wasn't exactly going to stop these people coming through, and then got over to South America, to Paraguay, to Brazil, to Argentina, places, to Chile. But several of them stayed, and West Germany, as it then was, is an interesting situation, because they're trying to set up their own intelligence network. They've had the country cut in two. They've got, you know, the East German, obviously the Stasi, etc. And tell me a little bit about Reinhard Gehlen then, and who he was, and what position he found himself in, and how he was able to even operate with a conscience.
Reinhard Gehlen is a fascinating figure. He's really in the center of my book. He was a German intelligence officer in the Second World War. He was responsible for intelligence analysis on the Eastern Front. And he understood earlier than some others that the Third Reich is going to lose. But unlike genuine resistance fighters in the German army, and there were several, he never risked himself by resisting Hitler. What he did was preparing a policy, an insurance policy. He took a stack of documents, virtually his secret archive, and buried it in the Bavarian mountains, somewhere in West Germany, in a place called Misery Meadows. And he understood that the Americans, after the war, will want to know more of the Soviets. We don't have enough intelligence on the Soviets. And he fought to exchange his secret archive in return for collaboration with the Americans. Immunity from trial, of course. And his dream was to establish the intelligence service of the new Germany, of post-war Germany, under American protection. And this is exactly what did. The new West German intelligence service, called the Gehlen Organization, actually began as a group of intelligence mercenaries under the Americans. There were many groups of former Nazis intelligence mercenaries. He was just one of them. But through very clever politics, he was able to push his competitors out of the game and be the only game in town. So he kind of remained the only functioning intelligence service in West Germany. The Americans were very suspicious of him most of the time. But here you have the fascinating mental mechanism of sunken costs. So the CIA always said, you know, this guy is not really reliable, he's very problematic, low-grade intelligence, but we invested so much in this service. So can we just undo the service now, close the organization? It makes no sense. So he remained the default option and established the intelligence organization of West Germany.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's what Willy Brandt would have called realpolitik, because they have to have some sort of service there. And obviously everybody else who's been involved, as long as you cannot point the finger of some of the atrocities at Gehlen, then I suppose the Americans or the Allies were saying, well, we have to have somebody there, because, you know, the Soviets are setting up their intelligence agencies. And I suppose the other thing is the fact that because of paperclip, which is we're taking the rocket scientists out, the people who'd worked on the V1, the V2, the short-lived V4 projects, they had already gone to help with the space program, the nascent space program. The Russians had stolen a load of jet technology from Eastern Poland for their Air Force and their space program. So I suppose it was a case of, well, it's almost like in Spain, as we had the Pact of Forgetting. So they were like, okay, well, we've got to do something with Germany. Everybody who is, you know, who's been in the administration, is functional. So therefore, we have to have these people to have some sort of structure.
Here you have something fascinating. You know, you cannot manage a German state after the Second World War without employing former Nazis, because virtually everybody in a position of authority was a Nazi in some sense, or a collaborator with the Nazis. And therefore, many people feared that West Germany is going to be a Nazi country. In the 1950s, in the 1960s, you can read many such predictions in the press. So many former Nazis in the German government, in the intelligence organizations, in the new German army, in the parliament, in the political system. So this country is going to become a Fourth Reich. It didn't happen. Why? Because, and that's what I try to emphasize in my book, after 1945, Hitler's defeat was so disastrous that even former Nazis understood that you cannot maintain Nazi ideology in its entirety. You have to pick and choose something out of Hitler's rubbish heap. So for most former Nazis who collaborated with West Germany and the United States, anti-communism was what they wanted to keep. And in return, they adopted democracy and discarded anti-Semitism and racial fury. But for other Nazi spies, and I show it in the book as well, hatred to the West or to Western democracy was the thing to keep and choose. And that's why they preferred to cooperate with the Soviets. And such people became Soviet moles inside West German intelligence organizations.
And that's an extremely interesting one, because to put it mildly, the Soviets loathed the Nazis after what the Nazis had done to the people of Belarus and the people of Russia, the huge destruction. I mean, the massive burnt earth policy, as we would call it, and the indiscriminate killings on an industrial scale. You would have thought that the first reaction of any Soviet intelligence officer, having a former Nazi saying, hey, I can do things for you, would be literally to put a bullet in his brain.
You know, intelligence officers are rarely sentimental people. Just as Alan Walsh Dallas, the legendary head of CIA, once said on one of his former... he said it on Galen, actually. I don't know if he's a scoundrel. There are few archbishops in espionage. He's on our side, and that's all that matters. The Soviets had the very same mentality.
So what was the situation like then? Because the book talks about, obviously, that they were not only hired as intelligence, but also, you know, assassins, hitmen, because they could, you know, having very little, if you like, moral fiber, they would just work for the highest bidder. They were the purest sort of mercenaries. And we can go back to Germany and its mercenary all the way back to Landeschnecks in the Renaissance. But, you know, we have holdouts as I said before, there are holdouts in Franco's Spain. There are safe houses. There are situations in smuggler-infested Yugoslav ports, you describe, and posh German restaurants. It is something from an espionage movie, because it's more, because it has actually happened.
So what I describe is an international network of neo-Nazis called Otrako. Otrako is Orient Trading Company, short acronym for Orient Trading Company. These people were Nazis who chose to maintain hatred to the West and to the Jews, and were ready to discard anti-communists. So many of them worked with the Soviet Union, and most of all, they supported Third World independence movements in order to undermine the position of France and the United States and other Western countries they hated. And these are the smugglers that I described that worked on these Yugoslavian ports and the German restaurants. One of the main discoveries of the book is tracing and following this international neo-Nazi network of arms smugglers called Otrako. And I describe it in detail, of course, in Fugitives.
That's a really interesting one, because you talk about destabilizing France, because after the Second World War, if you think about the French colonies, you think about Algeria, for example, and you think about what was happening in Indochina, And we know what happened with France in the 50s and, you know, Bien Bien Phu, et cetera, and they lose their colonies. So to destabilize nations, I mean, Britain has its empire looking, you know, and that the Commonwealth, they did Africa, et cetera. But to destabilize these nations is also part of, if you like, the Soviets wanting to make the West really, you know, really suffer after the Second World War, the destabilization, the dismantling of old empires in Britain and in France as well.
So, you see, I do not want to create a myth of a, like, all-pervading, omnipotent, international neo-Nazi network that destabilized states. I really want to emphasize this. These people were miserable cooks. And by themselves, they didn't influence any. They had dreams of grandeur, but it was mostly, like, illusions. What really mattered was the overreaction of states and governments to their presence. Because the French were so terrified that former Nazis smuggled weapons to Algeria, for example, that they started, the French Secret Service started to assassinate these people. And the campaign of assassinations poisoned the relationship between West Germany and France. And this had historical meaning. So what I'm trying to say is that the international network of neo-Nazis didn't matter. What mattered was the panic and the fear they arose in states and the overreaction of secret services and governments.
So where did you get this information from? Where did you find this information? Because it is, and excuse me for using a lowest common denominator, but it is a James Bond movie. It is the thought of, you know, Western powers, you know, bumping off each other's agents, the Soviet agents, ex-Nazis working. I mean, it is more fascinating than anything that fiction can come up with. So where do you get this information?
So I tried to rely as much as I could on archives, on original documents, and not on secondary literature. Because there are many unreliable books that just, you know, recycle myths. And that was just what I was trying to avoid. So I received really unprecedented access to the Mossad archives, partial access, but I received a lot of interesting folders and documents, the West German Secret Service, which really opened up, and the CIA, plus snippets from France. The French archives are relatively close. I interviewed people as much as I could. I relied very carefully on memoirs, interviews, testimonies. And the most fun part was actually getting documents from secret informers. People who did not want their name mentioned, they gave me disk on keys, you know, USB with all sort of documents which are closed, and I used them very carefully after for cross-checking and assessing their reliability. So this was a very interesting detective book, 4 years before writing this book.
And I mean, does it leave, when you look at history, because history can be very personal, but when you read about this, sitting in Jerusalem, putting this together, and you read about, you know, people like Helen, who survived the war and enjoyed the peace, does it leave a bad taste in your mouth, as we would say? I mean, these people were Nazis. They should have been brought to justice. They should have been served at least long prison terms. Or is it just, again, as I said before, it was a case of the real politic and the struggle between communism, the West, and the information these guys had went that, you know, ideological terms to hunting these people to the ends of the earth kind of had to take a back seat because they had to get on with the ordinary day of struggle between East and West.
You know, I tend to be sympathetic to historical figures and very sympathetic to the pressures they faced. Nobody knew in 1945 that there wouldn't be a real Third World War between the Soviets and the Western powers. We know that now. They did not know it at the time. And they knew that the Soviets outnumbered them. So judging from their position at the time, it is understandable why they used a German or former Nazi figures. Gehlen was not a war criminal, by the way. They actually employed much worse war criminals elsewhere. So he was not the worst case. I think that also you cannot punish everyone. Nazi Germany was a state which the entirety of the state was involved in genocide in some way or the other. You cannot punish everybody. The best thing to do after the war, in my opinion, and it was not done, was to kind of give amnesty to most Germans and to concentrate and really execute the worst criminals immediately. That was not done. In the beginning, they tried to catch everybody. That's why many really, really bad criminals escaped, and then they lost interest. If you want to punish genocide perpetrators, do it immediately, before the anger dissipates, and choose and focus on the groups of the worst criminals. I think that's the lesson from the Second World War.
The book is called Fugitives, A History of Nazi Mercenaries During the Cold War. It's by Danny Orbach, who we've been speaking to today. Danny, if people want to find you on social media, do you have social media? Is there a website? Where can people go to find some more information on this fascinating tale?
Sure. Yeah, I'm very active on Facebook under Danny Orbach. I'm very active on Twitter. And I also have a blog called The Owl.
What's it called? What's the blog called again, please?
The Owl, like the bird.
The Owl. Okay. This book is called Fugitives, A History of Nazi Mercenaries During the Cold War. It's by Danny Orbach, who we've been speaking to today. It will also be available as a virtual download from our bookstore. Danny, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much.